Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So this is the second day of the retreat, I guess you can say. At least one whole day, 24 hours already. And first of all, most important is that we have some awareness, some reflection upon what our experience has been. Now, there's these various instructions and various guidelines, but within these guidelines and these instructions, I mean, the most important part is what our experience is. I can say the instructions are kind of trying to guide us towards kind of an experience, but each person is very different. We each have our own particular temperament. We have our own different, say, levels of practice. You can maybe even say you have your own particular Australian karma or something. But even within these guidelines of the instructions and the teachings, I mean, our experience is one thing, and you can, on one hand, you can use the instructions to kind of guide your practice. On the other hand, you can use it as sort of a framework to get some perspective on it as well. I mean, some people they figure, oh, I don't need religion, you know, I just kind of, you know, sit there and watch my mind and get enlightened. That's what I thought 40 odd years ago. Fortunately, I survived. I know quite a few monks didn't. I mean, they didn't survive their mind, and they didn't survive the monastic form either. So after a while, I think I had some kind of, I don't know what you call it, some kind of favorable conditions, maybe. Because I had my own ideas of what meditation was. And unfortunately, I was able to go quite early on to a meditation monastery in a country called Sri Lanka. So I could learn meditation from a teacher and get some kind of experience anyway. I must admit, it was pretty intense and pretty confusing. I just kind of wandered in off the street, knowing nothing about Buddhism, basically. And then they put me in this little room, 6 feet by 4 feet, and said, "Watch your mind." No reading, no writing, no speaking, except to the one monk who came to talk to us. And sit there and watch your mind. Yeah. Oh, first of all, try and watch your breath first. But yeah. I'd just been traveling for 2 years, a year and a half by then, I guess. So mine was all full of all these travel stories, and didn't know much about Buddhism. And when I first began to sit, my knees were up around my ears. Now without a cushion, they are too, still. just up to my shoulders now. But somehow I had some kind of a useful experience. I must say it was hard work, and it was pretty confusing, but something did kind of gel with me. Something kind of happened. You know, for example, one experience was that my mind, I did experience some peace of mind. The first time in my whole life I ever experienced a peace of mind was in this meditation center. So I thought, oh, maybe it's meditation's doing it. It obviously, you know, isn't the food, because I've been eating the food for a while. It must be the, must be the exercises, you know. And I had a scientific bent of mind, and so I just put it together, you know, with cause and effect. As, you know, the Buddha also says, you know, if you do the actions, you get the results. So, for example, we come here and try and watch the breathing, for example, as the simplest exercise. And maybe for some people, maybe you've already experienced some degree of calm. Yeah, right? Somebody, please? Okay, it's a bit early, you know, it's only 24 hours or so, but maybe it takes a bit longer if you've got to book yourself in for a week or two, maybe. But probably, you know, if you did stay for maybe a bit longer and could use this time to focus on the breathing, the mind would eventually calm down to some degree. But from the Buddhist perspective, that's only half the practice. Technically, it's called calm and insight. You know, in the Pali language, samatha vipassana. So two sides to Buddhist meditation, two parts to it. And probably most people have heard about the calm part. That's usually what goes under the name of meditation. You sit there and focus on the breathing or some mantra or something, and your mind calms down, and aha, that's it. Of course, then you get up from your seat, and then your mind goes back to normal again, and what happened? So when I was in this meditation center, you know, I was there for a month, see, not just 24 hours, more than 24 days. And it wasn't just a steady progression either. I mean, my mind it got worse first, you know, here's this busy mind, been traveling, lots of experiences, and then put in a little room, it got a lot worse first. I thought the Buddha talked about the, you know, cessation of suffering. When somebody asked Ajahn Chah about that, he said, oh, you know, the Buddha's talking about, you know, suffering and the cessation of suffering, the end of suffering. But it seems that when I come here, my life is increased in suffering. He said, well, this is the suffering to end suffering. You know, it's like putting yourself in a little bit of a hothouse environment, you see. And so that allows you, and, you know, allows you to confront, as it were, suffering. Like, people are suffering anyway, but most people have so many choices to get away from it. Huh? Get a little bit of discomfort and go off and do something else. I mean, distract yourself. And that's probably one of the qualifications of civilization. More ways to distract yourself. You know, people who live in the simple villages in northeast Thailand have very few possibilities to distract themselves. So they're a bit more, they confront a lot more directly, you know, just the ordinary suffering of life. And I mean, it was a bit of a shock to me when I first went there, because people really did, I mean, they didn't have many choices. I mean, when it was hot, it was hot, and no air conditioning. When there wasn't enough rain, they starved. There wasn't any food. But of course, the Buddha was talking also about not just physical suffering, and what is more, probably more useful or relevant to us is our mental suffering on one level. And we all experienced what you can say is existential suffering. Since we're all, every human being, every sentient being is subject to old age, sickness, and death. I mean, it's a little bit too, you know, too abstract for many of us, especially we're so young, right? So well, some of us, some of you are anyway. I think I might be one of the oldest ones here. Oops, I'm feeling alone. I feel lonely. Different generation. But in a practical way, the Buddha's, you can say, at least in our Western situation here, probably most of our suffering is more mental. You don't go hungry. Well, air conditioning, not here, but at home you probably have air conditioning and heaters and things, But what about our mind? We suffer a lot from our mind, not knowing how to live with our mind in a peaceful way. So people have interest in meditation practice, and so they come to a place like a monastery, or they learn about meditation in other ways. And we had the opportunity to come here this weekend, and most important is, to be able to have the experience. I mean, like I mentioned yesterday, even to recognize that your mind is not peaceful. Very, very valuable. Very valuable lesson. When you know that your mind, say, is not peaceful, then probably most of you would appreciate a way to find peacefulness of mind, right? It's only if you recognize, you can really acknowledge that you are sick, that you go to the doctor. So many people, human beings, are suffering, but refuse to acknowledge it for one reason or another. When I went to Thailand, I was a bit, I went there to learn meditation or take another meditation retreat. After the one in Sri Lanka, actually a very short time, the effects wore off. Because one of the difficulties was it was a retreat center. So the life there was very artificial. All the food is provided. We didn't have to do anything. They gave us the clothes. They gave us soap to wash with. The teacher was there every day to explain the instructions if we needed some guidance. All we had to do was just meditate. That's all we had to do. That was more than enough. But of course, as soon as I left there, I asked to come and stay for a month, and the teacher said, okay. After 1 month, one day the teacher just came and said, okay, your month is up, bye-bye. And I'm out in the street, kind of. I recognize I had psychic shock from being in this totally sheltered environment where everything's provided. They ring the bell for you, and then I'm out on the street, and then I got to think, oh, where am I going? What's this funny money here? What's this funny stuff? I couldn't recognize the money. I hadn't used the money for a month. I hadn't even wore ordinary clothes for a month. They gave us the clothes to wear even, So here I was, not wearing white anymore. And suddenly my blue jeans look really dirty. And then I have to get the bus into Colombo. And, going from this very peaceful monastery in the countryside into the big city, I was just totally confused by it all. What's happening here? So basically, because my meditation experience, what I learned and my experience of meditation was conditioned by that very special environment, as soon as I left it, how do you continue? It's so artificial. I learned the principles, I could sit there anywhere, basically, and watch your breath, but nobody rang the bell for me. I think about finding food, find a place to sleep. So quickly the mind got very busy again, and so the tranquility went away very quickly. Then after I traveled again, went back to university in Canada again, and then I was sitting there one day and I thought, gee, my mind is so just like before, my mind's back to confusion again. Was that experience in Sri Lanka just a one-off experience? But, the Buddha did say, about cause and effect. If you do the practice, you get the results. And so, maybe I should try again. And there's no place to practice in Vancouver. So, okay, this time I'll go to Thailand because somebody told me there's lots of meditation teachers in Thailand. So I traveled to Thailand. So, make a longer story short, I got to Thailand, but lots of meditation teachers, but they don't speak English. I didn't think of that. It takes you 5 years, at least 5 years, to learn Thai before you can talk to them. Also, it took me, I had one, they give you a 1 month visa in those days, 45 years ago. So it took me 3 weeks to find a quiet monastery. I had the address of one meditation monastery, but went to the tourist office and they said, "Oh, Wat Pling? Wat Preng? Wat Pling? Wat Pling?" They didn't even know where the place was. I guess maybe they couldn't read English 45 years ago or something. But I did find a quiet place to practice in. But it wasn't a meditation monastery per se, but a meditation center. So I was given a little hut, and I was given some food left over from the monks just to meditate on my own. And I was quite happy because, I already learned the technique, just needed the place and the encouragement. So it wasn't quite the same intensity. In this meditation center in Sri Lanka, there was maybe half a dozen of us Westerners there. And they rang the bell, and everybody you get some group support. Everybody else is meditating. Nobody else is talking. So nothing to do but meditate. Nothing else to do. But in this monastery in Thailand, I could just kind of wander in the forest. I could go out to the restaurant or something, but I thought I'd make use of my time there. Only had not a week left, At the end of the week, I thought, maybe I need a bit longer, so I get another visa for another month, you see. So my plan of 1 month became 2 months. And it went on exactly for 9 years, but kept renewing my visa. But the most important part of it was I had the opportunity to, find a place which supports meditation. Even though, even the other monks there didn't meditate necessarily. A lot of them didn't practice. But they did recognize that this was, they were encouraging for me to do it, you see. They didn't have time, but you can do it for us. But it's helpful that we have, say, a supportive environment and a place like this place here now in Australia. You don't have to go to Thailand and learn Thai for 5 years. And you get the benefit of Thai cooking, too. But this particular, this meditation practice, the most important part is to get to know your mind. So, it is helpful. You could just, sit at home and just watch your mind, yes, but what's happening there? I know when I first started meditating in Sri Lanka, the teacher, he only more or less said a sentence or two every day, how's your mindfulness? Continue. yes, but just continue. Actually, he spoke very good English, so I could have asked him some, deep questions, but he didn't want to hear it. He just said, meditate. You find out for yourself. like this theme of this retreat, what's the cause of this thought? If you take that as a meditative inquiry, you could say, well, you could work on that. And maybe for the rest of your life, you could work on that inquiry. And as long as you knew something about the basics, that it's very helpful to have a basis of calm, calm before insight. The Buddha did say you can have calm and then insight, or insight and then calm, or both together. And some teachers in Thailand, they emphasize a lot of calm meditation. Like you can develop calm meditation for the next 20 years if you want. Others, they just say, don't bother too much. Just go right to insight meditation. So you just watch the rising, falling of your abdomen and you know, and then you notice impermanence, and then you're sotapanna. That's all. That's the first paragraph, you see, of their instructions. But my own experience, I traveled around a bit in Thailand and met a number of teachers, and my own preference was to return to Ajahn Chah's monastery. And my understanding was he didn't use those terms, but he was more or less teaching calm, insight together. So, you know, one of my kind of questions I asked quite a few different meditation masters in Thailand, one of my questions was, how much calm do we need? Anybody have that question? Because, I mean, in theory, they talk about right mindfulness, I mean, right concentration. Right concentration is four absorptions to the fourth absorption, which is very, very peaceful state of mind. I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of, if you hear about that, you kind of give up hope, actually. Well, I would anyway. But very, very deep concentration. That's right concentration in the Eightfold Path. And the various teachers have different interpretation of that, you see, how much concentration you need. Because most people understand meditation as starting off with calm meditation, focusing attention. Some traditions end there. Just concentration, that's all you need. That's what I thought. But understanding the principle of the Buddha's teachings, calm and insight. Insight is developing mindfulness, which can lead to an inquiry. And it's helpful that it's supported by calm, so that this mindfulness is a calm, or an inquiry based upon calm. So if you ask that question, what's the cause of my thought? Without a basis of calm, you probably start thinking about the answer, right? Yeah. Let's see. Maybe it's the cause of my thought. Maybe it's because, you know, my mother didn't love me enough. Maybe it's because of my bad karma. Yeah. You could wear your brain out. And probably never, I mean, you might get some sort of called answers, but they aren't the right one. They aren't the real answer. But from a basis of calm, you can begin to experience a deeper level of mind, if you like. What concentration does, you can say in a practical sense, it raises your level of consciousness. And you have more concentration. It gives the mind some energy, it focuses the mind, see? So it gives the mind some power, and the mind begins to see the quality rather than the quantity. So concentration gives you the depth of mind. Mindfulness gives you the breadth of mind. The danger of too much focus is, you know, you can just focus, and you can, your mind can be very powerful, and you get very blissful too, because the experience is that you're focusing on an object. There's a subject, me focusing on an object, and the focusing, and a subject and object come together. And then you have samadhi, one-pointedness of mind, or you can say kind of a unity of consciousness. So it's very, very blissful, because you forget yourself. You know, nothing there but just breathing, no breather. No problems with the breather either. However, you know, the Buddha practiced this meditation, this kind of meditation, to a very, very advanced level, and his experience was, hey, but eventually you got to come out of that unitary consciousness, eventually. And you're back to your old self again. Okay, you can say, well, in a way, it's a little bit rarefied self, because at least it knows that it can experience that state of selflessness temporarily, see. Practically what it does is that if your normal state of mind is very, very busy, it's on many different things. You're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking all at the same time, whether you do it or not. So there's many things in the mind, so of course your mind's not peaceful. You're hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, going on, so the mind's not very peaceful. But you take one object, like breathing, And you focus on that, focus on that, focus. Very simple, isn't it? You know, simpleness of mind, so one-pointedness of mind becomes peacefulness of mind on one thing, especially if it's something peaceful like breathing. So, but in practice, though, all it does is raise one thing up to prominence in your consciousness, and all the other stuff just goes to the background. So it can seem like, if you have fairly good concentration, you can seem like no problems. Yeah, yeah. I don't know how many times in Thailand I was sitting there, and you know, and my mind got very peaceful. Here I was in this meditation monastery, and you know, mostly I just meditated almost all day long. Nobody bothered me. 15, 16 hours a day, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, just breathing, breathing, breathing. Even my mind slowed down. Nothing to do, just meditate, watching breathing, breathing. One time I was in my little hut there, my little room, and then I heard this visitor come, and I had the downstairs room, and another monk was upstairs, Western monk, and people knew this Western monk, so they used to come and see him. Many taxi drivers knew about him, so they would direct people to go and see this Buddhist monk who spoke English and German and Thai. And so I heard somebody coming, and I heard the monk say, "Oh, go downstairs. I'll come and see you downstairs." And that's where I was sitting meditation, you see. Just this close to enlightenment. You know? And I heard this guy come down the steps, and I thought, "Oh, no, he's going to disturb my awakening." And so I heard him come down the steps, and he opened the door, and I was sitting on the floor, and he didn't see me there. So he kind of walked in, looked around, and he saw me there, and then he comes running over to me, and he says, "Hello, I'm Joe Smith." And I said, "Hello, I'm breathing." And I couldn't remember who I was. Totally forgot who I was, my personality. I was just breathing. That's all I was doing. And then, of course, I had to come around and say, "Oh, yes, I'm so-and-so." And then my ego stories came back again, you see, blah, blah, blah. I'm this person, Canadian, blah, 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 blah. Oh, shattered my enlightenment. But so many times, you know, when the mind calms down, you think, you know, no thoughts in the mind. Look, there's no greed, no aversion, no delusion. That's the definition of nibbana, enlightenment. I'm there. But I like it. Oh, there's some greed there. Oops. Oops, I lost it. I have aversion too. I don't know what's happening. I have delusion as well. Oops, I'm back to square one again. Ajahn Chah gave the analogy that it's concentration like putting a stone on the grass, you see. So it looks like the grass is dead. Yeah. There's no grass there. But as soon as you take the stone off, the grass starts growing again because it's still got the roots of it, you see. So when you have concentration, you aren't looking at the roots. You aren't looking at the grass. You're just focusing on breathing. And so, aha, that's all there is, breathing, and no problems. So it's a temporary abiding in peace. But then you eventually have to come out of that, and then you start being subject and object again, you see? And then all the problems are right there again. So that's why insight meditation, the Buddha discovered insight meditation. And probably the most important insight he had, which is now called insight meditation, is the insight into the principle of cause and effect, or I translate it as conditional causality. That things arise from a cause. Everything arises from a cause except nibbana. And unless you get down to the cause, these things are going to continue. So this becomes the basis of the Buddha's first Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths: there is unsatisfactoriness, it has a cause, and when you can remove the cause, It realized cessation of suffering then. Most people, you know, they have suffering, unsatisfactoriness. They don't know how to transcend it. They don't know how to deal with it. So they have to just ignore it or escape from it somehow. But the Buddha traced it to a cause, and if you can remove that cause, it's gone. So people they look at the suffering, and then, you know, they try and sort it out, try and figure it out, do something with it, but it's only an effect. It's not the real issue. The real issue is the cause, unless you get to the root of it. You know, following that example, that analogy of the grass again, you know, somebody has some weeds growing, so they just pull the weed. They just cut the weed off. You see? A week later, it's growing again. Uh-huh, why is that? I just cut it off. I keep cutting it off, and aha, there's a root to it, and there's a source to it. If you pull up the root, no more weeds. Saves lots of scissors. But, you know, most people don't see it. They don't see that it's got a root to it. They just see that, you know, you just see the grass stick coming up, right? That's the most obvious thing. But like this theme, for example, what's the cause of this thought? It's trying to point out, trying to remind you. There's a cause, there's a root to it, there's a source to it. Don't get distracted by the thought. What's behind it? What's the source of it? And I realized last night I should have said something like, you know, what are the causes of this thought? Because it's not quite so simple as there's one cause. Usually there's a whole train of cause and effect, actually. Yeah. A whole series of things. But we are, you know, with some degree of mindfulness, which is supported by calm. You have some degree of calm, the mind calms down somewhat. Your reactiveness, your busyness of mind calms down. You have to know how much. So Ajahn Chah, his recommendation was, you know, when I asked these different teachers, some of them said, oh, the first absorption at least. Some said the fourth absorption at least you need for calm before you turn to insight meditation. So I asked Ajahn Chah, how much calm do we need? And he just said, as usual, you know, in a very kind of practical way, he just said, oh, just calm enough. Yeah, right. Continue. Calm enough. He was a master of never giving a straight answer. Of course, I was frustrated because I wanted a number, you see. First level, second level, third level, fourth level, whatever, but he just said, calm enough. I must admit, it took me, I don't know how many years before I could appreciate the wisdom of that answer. Because calm enough, first of all, it's sort of like an open answer, right? Calm enough for what? Calm enough for insight. So it keeps that in your mind. Calm is not the end. Calm enough for development of insight meditation. And then each one of us has to know for herself. Each one of us has our own particular temperament. We have our own particular qualities of mind. For some people, you know, very simply speaking, maybe their mind is very, very busy. They're very active. They have a very high-strung temperament. So calm enough means a lot of calm. For other people, they're pretty easygoing. They don't think about a lot of things. They don't worry about things too much. Then calm, you don't need enough. Don't need a lot of calm. And each time you meditate, each time we observe our mind, it's different. There's no magical formula. You know, sit for 5 minutes, sit for 15 minutes of calm, watching the breath before you turn to insight meditation. You got to know your own mind, see? So that's the most important part of it is, it's very experiential answer. You have to know yourself. First of all, you have to know your own mind. You have to know what calm is. You know, some people, their experience of calm is really just dullness. no problem. That's not calmness. That's not tranquility, because there's no awareness in it. Not, you know, you try and bring some awareness into it, and your mind isn't calm anymore. For other people, maybe their experience of calm is quite superficial. It's just very momentary. Others, they can experience deeper levels of calm, where the mind stays very stable, even with a lot of input, a lot of stimulation. There still is a deeper level of calm in the mind. It's maintained. So the first aspect of meditation is to explore what calm is. I know for myself, my very first experience of calm, I got frightened. Yeah. When the thinking stopped, who am I? Identification with the thinking was so strong that when the thinking stopped, I didn't know who I was. So immediately, I mean, I just had a moment of calm, and then I started thinking again, really, really quickly, thinking about myself again. This identity was so strong. And now I can appreciate, you know, giving my brain a rest sometime. And don't worry about it. When the thinking quiets down, then it's even more peaceful experience of myself, if you like. Don't need to think about myself. But first of all, we explore the different kinds of calm, and then keeping that perspective in mind, calm for insight meditation. That's increasing more awareness with regard to development of mindfulness, bodily sensations, feeling tones, states of mind. And then the fourth category is the dhammas, or it's like the phenomena. Which is a kind of like an extension of states of mind and certain themes, Buddhist themes to contemplate, such as the six senses, six sense sphere, you know, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, how they interact with the environment and then create your world. So just I mentioned that particular theme, you know, what's the cause of this thought. And probably because, I know many people have said to me they have a lot of thoughts in their mind, what to do with them. You know, how to stop my mind from thinking so much? Yeah. And you won't stop it by trying to stop it. The kind of practical advice is that if you move your attention from your thoughts to something like the breathing, then the thoughts will fade away, without you having to push them away. And then if you do this, you know, you can just move your attention. What you attend to energizes whatever you attend to. So you attend to your thoughts, you start thinking again, energizes your thoughts. So when you just move your attention to your breathing, then the thoughts will quieten down. Of course, it takes some practice, usually some continuity and perseverance, until you learn the benefits of being able to withdraw your attention from thinking. At the same time, you know, it's possible when you need to think, you just turn your attention back to your thoughts again. So you can still use your thinking when you need to, but you aren't controlled by them. You aren't overwhelmed by them. And then the second part of it is when we're able to calm our thinking to some degree, to observe. What's the thinking process all about? What kind of thoughts happen in this mind? And I mentioned yesterday kind of the three primary ones the Buddha mentions first. If these thoughts have to do with greed, aversion, delusion, it's not so much looking at the specific thoughts. Of course, you have specific thoughts. You know, I think about this particular person or this particular event. Okay, you know, you could, what's the cause of that? You might get a bit more personal about it. A personal story comes out of it. But looking at the general tendencies now, this has to do with attraction and desire and wanting and greed, or pushing away, aversion, rejection. It's just confusion, delusion or confusion, uncertainty, doubt, worry, fear. That's the general category. And then You can, when you can do that, I mean, some of these states of mind, of course, can be quite energized, quite volatile. Yeah. For example, something like anger or aversion. I mean, there's different kinds of aversion. Yeah. And maybe living, you know, being in a very quiet, peaceful environment like this, nothing to really stir up much aversion. Huh? Yeah. Maybe the smoke today and that caused you any aversion? So, you know, you could maybe turn to that. If it was any some degree of aversion, you could turn to it. Your mind is reasonably calm and look at it. First of all, what is it? How does it express itself? You know, some of these states of mind, they are very volatile. They kind of arise very quickly and pass away. Others kind of simmer in the background. You know, some kind of gather strength and then fade out. And they say there's some people who are very quick to anger, but quick to give it up to. Others, they just simmer along, you see, with resentment or something. And it's never really, it doesn't really, you know, you say, how are you doing? Oh, fine. And you get this kind of heavy vibe out of them, you know. Fine, but you don't look fine. They refuse to acknowledge basically how they are, I think. So it can be a bit harder to maybe notice some of these states of mind, for example, in this case. But you can cross-reference them. You know, I gave you that exercise of moving attention through the body to different parts of the body. So if you were to inquire, what's the state of mind right now? And blank. Yeah. Look in the body. Yeah. I gave you a little bit of a hint there, with especially being aware of the sensation in the center of your chest, the heart area. Yeah. If you bring your attention there and you feel some heaviness of heart, heaviness of your chest, yeah, what's the associations with that mentally? Does it bring up a state of mind? Heavy-heartedness, sadness, I don't know, whatever. You don't want to kind of feed your experiences, but... But when you begin to read the body, sometime, I would say many times, that to me, the body is more honest and more direct than my mind. And if I ask myself what my state of mind is kind of, you can look at it different ways, you see. Depends how truthful I want to be. How I can fool myself much better with my mind than I can with my body, you see. The body is a bit not so clever, you see. It's very direct. So you notice a sensation in the body, and there it is. You don't need to argue with it. Maybe it's sometimes a bit harder to read, because some of us are not very familiar with our body. But when you can recognize some of these sensations, then you can just open up to them. And see if you can open up into the emotional realm, the mental realm, and what does that remind you of? What's the associations there? You know, this heaviness in your heart. What are the associations there? And if you do notice getting more energized or empowered, and you lose the calm, back to the calm again. Very helpful to stay with at least a basis of calm. It doesn't need to be 100% calm. I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, maybe 50-50. Yeah? You can be aware, you can have your attention on your breathing 50%. 50% on your state of mind. Or if you're a very nervous temperament, maybe you may get 70% calm. Or if you have quite a bit of experience of calm, 20% calm and 80% observing this particular sensation in the body or state of mind. To become more familiar with these various experiences we have, I mean, most of us have these experiences anyway. It's not a matter of creating them. They're there anyway. Most of us don't know how to observe them carefully with clarity and mindfulness and awareness. But from a calmer place, we are not so reactive about them, so we can observe them as they are. Yeah. Something like anger. I mean, if Most people, they observe some anger, and then they get angry at themselves for being angry. You know, they can even acknowledge it. And then they get frightened about themselves being angry about their anger, and then they get confused about them being frightened about their... Now you've got a long story there. Maybe you can make a Hollywood movie out of it, you see. But it started off with aversion, anger. That was the thing that was there. And you built all this story around it, and you're off in the cloud somewhere. And you can't actually observe what the real issue was anymore, with all your reactiveness around it. When the mind is more calm, then you can observe. There it is. And if it's hard to observe in your mind, look in the body. There it is, right there. There's heat in my belly. And there's this tension in the muscles. There is a heart beating stronger. That's the physical expression of anger. Huh? Right? Well, we have our own brand of it, each one of us. But but when we get more familiar with these experiences, especially with, you know, again, I keep reminding you the basis of calm, because it's the calm which allows us to observe these processes. And then Buddha points out that, you know, particularly some of them, the ones which are either negative, first of all, or positive, you try to investigate what the causes are. What's the root cause behind it? So I'll give you a little bit of a hint, maybe. Probably the most profound, I would say, the most profound aspect of the Buddha's teachings is his teaching about causality. So he's pointing at the importance of understanding the causal processes involved. And he gave some formal teachings about the different processes there, but then we try to personalize them to our own experience. But I'll give you a little bit of a hint anyway about something like aversion. You read more about it in my book about the hindrances, but but maybe this chance, this opportunity, you can work with it a little bit. If you notice, for example, some kind of a rejection, a pushing away, and aversion syndrome, the basic cause of an aversion syndrome is unpleasant feeling tone. So you can cross-reference. I mentioned sensations in the body, but also feeling tones. That's the second area of our experience to be aware of. Feeling tones, simple, right? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. But the feeling tones are fundamental to all of our experience. Every time we are conscious, we have feeling, feeling tone, whether you know it or not. Many times, of course, it's not very obvious, doesn't stand out. It's either pretty neutral, you know, or it's not very empowered. But there's some feeling tone there, and we develop awareness with regard to feeling tone. You can begin to tune into some kind of basic primal responses to our environment. When you see something, what's the feeling tone there? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. When you're aware of a state of mind, and I mentioned, if you know, it's something sort of in the pushing away, the kind of rejection area, basis is behind it is an unpleasant feeling tone. So, I mean, there's a very simple, you know, cause and effect relationship here. Now when I hear people who are angry, I don't hear their anger, I hear their pain, because what's behind it is their pain. Somebody's in pain, and then they react with aversion somehow. Rage, frustration, some kind of negative, averse reaction. If their pain is removed, their anger goes away. Simple. Of course, we're very complex human beings, and so some people get a lot of energy out of their anger. So, you know, even they're in pain, they love it, actually, you know, because it gives them a reason for living. It's not quite so simple. They're called masochists. But at least it gives them a, you know, point of reference, you know. So if you begin to observe some of these states of mind, and first of all, recognize them, the Buddha's pointing out, first of all, the first stage is being mindful of these particular experiences, physical sensations, feeling tones, you get familiar with them. On one hand, you know, developing awareness with regard to physical sensations is pretty easy, because the body, we have the body here all the time. On the other hand, many people are up in the brain so much, they lost contact with their body, so they're very disembodied. So to be bringing more awareness back to your body requires some effort. It's like relearning a foreign language. You know, what's the body saying, actually? Most people, they ask their body what the body's doing, and they go in their brain, and then they go in their brain to try and interpret what the body's saying, and aren't able to listen to the body itself. So to get some kind of strange interpretation of what the body's doing, rather than listen to the body directly. So you have to learn to read body language, if you like. And the same with feeling tones. Feeling tones are not a thought. You won't find a feeling tone in your brain. You look in the feeling realm of our experience. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It's the affective tone of your experience. And so we begin to develop this awareness with regard to these various areas of our experience. And you begin to understand them, the arising, what gives rise to them, how they pass away. And we come to the fourth category. You know, it is really about observing the positive states of mind, if you like, positive experiences, and the negative ones. The positive ones first. they are kind of formalized in what's called the seven factors of awakening. So there's some of these qualities are natural. We all have mindfulness, concentration. We have equanimity sometimes, tranquility. These are quite natural experiences, human experiences. But now the Buddha is saying, hey, but these, if we develop them, they become factors of awakening. Concentration, mindfulness, awareness, tranquility, equanimity, joy, or rapture, as well as investigation of Dhamma and energy. Is that seven? Anybody keeping count? About seven. And the negative ones are formally presented under the category of hindrances, the five hindrances. Now, when they first of all try to be aware of them, and then we try to observe what the cause is, because, you know, people, unfortunately, I mean, just the way our language works, you know, you see something like that, a hindrance, for example, you hear a hindrance, get rid of it. However, as far as understanding spiritual practice goes, if you hear about a hindrance, you know, actually, aha, there's a great chance now for wisdom. And you can become aware of a hindrance. Most people are hiding away from the so-called negative, you see. And it's their ignoring of these negative aspects of our experience, which becomes ignorance. So you aren't seeing reality as it really is. But now when you actually come across a so-called negative experience, a hindrance, here's a valuable source of wisdom now. I can investigate it and find out what its source is, where it's coming from. Yeah. And this is learning about the nature of ourself. How a sense of self is built up, you know, with all our stories. So just understanding the principle of cause and effect, just knowing that it exists, ideally we don't get too preoccupied with our first experience we have, the state of mind, okay, what's behind it? And, you know, that's where we wake up, whatever this is, this aversion or delusion or whatever, that's where we wake up, but what's behind it now? So this can then learn to expand our awareness to include not only this experience, but what's the cause and effect processes there involved. And when you can see through the whole processes, then they collapse, basically. And if you look at something like aversion, if you really observe it, you begin to see, first of all, what I observe, first of all, is the energy in it. You observe the energy in aversion, If you can tune into this energy, plug into it, you won't fall asleep. Have you ever fallen asleep when you're angry? Not easily, is it? I wouldn't suggest that if you feel sleepy to think about somebody you hate. You know, I wouldn't say that, because that may not be able to get out of it. It'll keep you awake, but not in a very nice way. But if you can observe that aversion, for example, at an energy level, you see a different dimension of it. Yeah, it's very powerful, but it's also very dangerous and, you know, toxic energy too. But now, how to deal with it in a skillful way now? First, we have to understand it before we can learn how to work with it now in a skillful way. So, I mean, the title of my book about the hindrances, I think Ajahn Khemavara mentioned it already, Working with the Hindrances, you see. Why I chose that title is because most people, they hear about hindrances and how to get rid of the hindrance then. I say, don't try. Don't try and get rid of it. Trying to get rid of it is already a hindrance, you see. Because one of the hindrances is aversion. So you don't like your hindrance, you've got aversion now. So, okay, you get rid of your greed, but then you increase your aversion. So, whereas if you can investigate them and study them, you learn nature, and this hindrance is actually just a smokescreen. These hindrances are expressions of your ego, of yourself. So it's just a smokescreen, because yourself doesn't want to see what's really behind that self, you see. So when you notice a hindrance, there's like a little red light on your dashboard flashing. Something's wrong here. You got to look a bit deeper. Find out what's the source of it, what's the cause of it, you see. And eventually you learn to go back deep into yourself then and find out the very roots of where you're grasping. What are you grasping that's coming out as aversion? What are you grasping that's coming out as greed or doubt or restlessness or sleepiness? And when you find out what the source of that is, it will fade away. It'll be transmuted, if you like, into wisdom. To self-knowledge then. And so the so-called hindrance, where is it? You know, it's just a smokescreen. It doesn't really exist in itself. It's like saying, where's the cloud? What is a cloud? It's just empty air, right? Yeah. How many times have you come down in the airplane and you're thinking you're going to hit that cloud and then right through it? All these thoughts in your mind are just clouds, you see. When you begin to see that, you don't take them so seriously. Yeah. Interesting thought, stupid thought, just a thought, just like a cloud. But we need to see that for ourselves. You know, otherwise behind it you think, oh, but that's my thought. And my thought is so important. Really? I mean, did you really think that thought? Or did that thought think you? And begin to observe the thoughts just more objectively, less subjectively, more objectively, you get a different perspective on them. Did you really think that thought? Where did it come from? I think I'm just picking up from somebody here. Except the intelligent ones, those come from me. But so if we continue with this practice, I mean, as I mentioned, they give the instructions this morning about maintaining a focused attention to be able to sustain some degree of calmness. And you know for yourself then, find out for yourself how much is calm enough. If you notice the mind, you know, you can just, if your mind says, recognizes calm, okay? You can put down the breathing if you like. And then try to expand your awareness now. Mindfulness, awareness to other sensations in the body besides the breathing. What's the feeling tone there? What's the state of mind right now? And if you notice a state of mind or a feeling tone that stirs you up, stirs the mind up, you start thinking about it, getting getting reactive to it, back to the breathing again. Yeah? So you can become more flexible then. Calm insight. So it takes a little bit of experience, a little bit of practice, but we begin to get some sense for it. You know, it's like learning to drive a car. You need to have to do it first before you know just how much to turn before the car turns. But this is all part of the process, and the more that we observe, you know, this process, the more we learn about ourselves. Basically, the more we practice, the more wiser we get. Whether it's so-called, you know, whether you notice pleasant things about your experience or unpleasant things isn't really important. It's all part of the whole process of meditation. And the more you know about yourself, the less traps, the less trip-ups you're going to have. Even noticing your weaknesses, very valuable. If you notice them, you can really acknowledge them, they won't trip you up again because you're conscious of them now. They tripped you up because you didn't notice them. You weren't conscious of them. When you're more aware of them, aha, watch out. Watch out for that one. So hopefully you can make your way much more wisely through life then, the more you learn about the nature of this mind and body, because we live with our mind and body our whole life. So the sooner you learn about it, the safer your life will be, not to mention wiser. So I think I should leave some time for questions, although it's already 9 o'clock. But actually, it's only 8 o'clock. You have an extra hour to sleep tonight, so, or meditate, or ask questions.
Hi, John. Thank you for your teachings. If someone's got a particularly agitated mind and is fearful about going to meditation, could you give some more guidance on how to start meditation? I had a very good observation today by walking outside and just keeping my eyes open and trying to concentrate on a cloud or a tree and the like. So closing eyes sometimes seems to stir up more.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can meditate with your eyes open. Yeah, I mean there's various methods you can try. I mean the basic instructions to sit cross-legged and bring mindfulness up to your bring awareness up to your breathing, closing your eyes, and these things are just basic, general exercises or general instructions. But each person needs to be able to apply them to our own experience. So we try the best we can, you know. Like somebody asked me, I think yesterday, about whether they have to sit in cross-legged to meditate. I mean, it's only a recommended posture for those who are able to do it without too much discomfort. If your body is very uncomfortable when you're sitting cross-legged, your mind isn't going to be peaceful. Your body's not peaceful. So it defeats the purpose. On the other hand, you know, being able to sit cross-legged or sit on the floor, I mean, it's more adaptable to all kinds of situations. You go to Thailand, you're not going to be hard to find a chair. When I first went to the monasteries in northeast Thailand, there wasn't any chairs. It didn't exist. Everybody had to sit on the floor. Didn't even have any cushions or mats. Just a concrete floor. That's why my knee is not so good anymore. So then maybe you can, you know, if closing your eyes is not conducive to providing, you know, a state which will support peace of mind, you can use your eyes open. Maybe, you know, maybe try to sometimes short periods to close them just to see what happens. The benefit of closing the eyes is it helps you to cut down sensory stimulation. And many people have a lot of sensory stimulation through the eyes, you see. So you could also, one of the instructions is that if you feel sleepy, for example, it could be better to open the eyes, but not to look at anything. Defocus your eyes and just observe a couple of meters in front of you. with defocused attention, defocused eyesight. You don't see any objects. You see something and usually start thinking about it. You see, that's a nice floor there. I wonder what the paint is like. I wonder how, what kind of wood is that? Gee, there's a lot of knots in there. So many knots in there, same as my brain. But if your eyes are closed, you don't even see it. And so, nothing to think about. So step by step, maybe. And then some people, you know, I think there's even one of the Zen traditions, they actually meditate with their eyes open, but they sit facing the wall, though. So, and I know one of the other Western monks in England, he recommends having the eyes open also. Yeah. But not to stare, not to look at anything in particular, you know, but just to sit there with your eyes open, defocused. So you keep more alert and awake. His experience was that people close their eyes and then fall asleep. Or drift off or hallucinate or something. You know.
Ajahn, I figure I didn't explain myself very well. It was about the agitation at the beginning of the question.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Your advice on the agitation. So I was looking for ways to deal with the agitation.
Yeah. Well, if you you know the what's causing, I mean, what's kind of what triggers it off, as it were, like being in an unfamiliar place, being in the dark, you know. So if we take that as a sort of a theme to observe what's causing it, what's behind it, you know, what are the triggers, maybe, whether it is, as it were, sort of like a more persistent, you know, state of mind or personality tendency or whatever, or is there particular triggers? Does it come and go? Is it only a temporary thing? If you have experienced this quite often in your life, is it familiar, unfamiliar, whatever? And maybe you begin to get some perspective on it. At the very least, you become more familiar, so it's not such a frightening prospect, you see. You know, the danger is that if we have some kind of very strong, you know, difficulties, we get traumatized by them, see, and afraid to go near them, so we're never going to be able to find out what they're really about. And then, of course, being able to develop some degree of calm meditation helps us to be able to maybe be not so reactive to these difficult tendencies. Because it tends to be the reaction to it, and then the counter reaction, and then it becomes a trauma.
Yeah.
One psychotherapist who deals with trauma, he talked about the vortex, and you get pulled into it. But to stay on the edge and just be able to touch into and observe this process, you see. So. Maybe some of this, you know, so-called kind of like agitation is sort of nervous energy, which perhaps can be dealt with by a bit more active meditation, like walking meditation, or gardening meditation or something, or swimming, or I was going to say skiing, but doesn't really apply here, does it? Water skiing. Quiet is part of the night. Ask for questions. All the minds go blank.
Is emotion categorized underneath feeling tone? Or
nope.
Sankara?
State of mind.
State of mind.
Yep.
In terms of five aggregates, which?
Sankara.
Sankara.
That's a little bit of something of a translation problem in the West, is, you know, they translate this Pali word vedana as feeling. But of course, in a Western, in English, we say, how are you feeling? You don't say pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. You know, you to give an emotion. So, and I remember trying to explain this to somebody in Switzerland, and we got into she got into an argument with me. I didn't argue with her, but and she had her degree in Buddhism, so she knew better than I did, you see. So she insisted feeling was an emotion. But she was from Germany, so maybe in German, I don't know, is it? I don't know German enough to know what Gefühl. It's an umlaut. Gefühl. Anybody speak German? Gefühl is probably, I think it's emotion. Close to feeling, you see. Gefühl. Anyway. So that's why I say feeling tone. I say Vedana's feeling tone. It's just the general tone. You can say general tone of the emotion, if you like. Whether it is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's not whether you're happy or sad, but whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So, and then the emotion would be a state of mind. When the Buddha is saying, you know, to in Chittanupassana, being aware of states of mind, he particularly points out being aware of anger, which is, we would say, is emotion, not a state of mind, or greed. Delusion, maybe you'd associate with state of mind. Yeah. But greed and aversion are more emotional. Once we know something about these particular states of mind, positive and negative, and especially the negative ones, the Buddha gives particular meditations. So like this focusing attention on breathing is only one, probably the simplest and most universal of the meditation topics, subjects. But there's 40 different meditation topics or subjects in Theravada Buddhism. But rather than, you know, I haven't got time to go through all 40 of them. I probably don't need them anyway. So you start off with something like breathing, pretty neutral, and then you may notice if there is particular strong tendencies. If you have particular strong aversion, for example, I mentioned that. The Buddha gives a particular meditation to use, practice of metta or friendliness. It's a particular meditation practice, which is probably the second most popular meditation subject in Thailand. First is breathing, focusing on breathing. Second one is a practice of friendliness or metta. And this can have some very, you know, I mean, the point of it is, as I understand it, is not to get rid of your anger, but to create a very skillful state of mind, which can then deal with the anger much more skillfully. See, the anger is pushing away, or friendliness is welcoming, right? Different energetic. So we're too imbalanced in pushing away reality. Maybe developing this meditation helps to get more balanced. We can learn to be friendly, even to the point of welcoming in difficulties. Unfortunately, some people think, you know, their usual way of thinking is, and it kind of dualistic thinking is, if I got too much anger, it'll take some metta and kill it. Kill it with metta. You know? No, that's not the right way. If you develop it properly, it changes your whole attitude. You know, this aversion attitude gets totally changed. You're more friendly to the so-called unpleasant. So your whole attitude changes, rather than you using it as an antidote to anger. Anyway, you got to try it. But it's more helpful if we, you know, have the experience first. We notice there's these particular strong tendencies, and then we can maybe, by recognizing what they are, recognizing there are other ways of developing the mind which can be supportive of working with them skillfully, then we can apply them. But then it'll come from what's relevant to us at this particular time in our meditation practice. Otherwise, some people, they read the book first, you know, like I did, read the book, and then they, you know, okay, got to do a bit of focusing on breathing, a bit of metta, a bit of a subha kamatana, a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of the other. Oops, into meditation. Before even doing it. Got to the end of it. Just thinking about which one to do, you see. 40 different choices. 40 different flavors of meditation. You can sit there and think for half an hour which one to do and run out of time to do any of them.
So you're not selecting beforehand, just what comes up in meditation.
Yep.
You're applying to the opponent. To
yep. If you notice there is these recurring themes, keep recurring again and again and again, then maybe it could require some assistance from some other type of meditation, not just watching the breathing and observing these particular tendencies, but if they keep getting reacted upon all the time, then maybe I could benefit from a little bit of this kind of meditation practice then. And then see what the effect is. And sometime maybe our first diagnosis isn't correct. You know, maybe we think it's aversion, maybe. But as I mentioned, you know, there's a whole cause and effect process here involved, and you know, maybe it's actually something else. Aversion is just a front for something else. You know, some people maybe they actually behind the aversion is a fear. Like when I was writing this book about the hindrances, somebody said to me, "Oh, what about fear?" And I put fear under doubt. They said, "Isn't fear anger?" Aversion. And I said, to me, my experience is anyway that anger is a reaction to the fear. Because fear is so unpleasant, most of us don't want it. We try and push it away. But to me, we're actually the root of fear is we don't know. So we're frightened what we don't know. So the unknowing is the root of fear, I would say. Not the aversion. The aversion is a reaction to it. Some people they might become aware of the aversion, but if you look behind it, there's fear and insecurity there. So that's what they're averse to, observing that fear, that uncertainty. So I mean, if you do some friendliness practice to the aversion, maybe it allows you to see deeper too. See? To me, the practice of friendliness. That's why I translated this friendliness. Sometimes it's translated as loving kindness, which I find a little bit too high-minded myself. But friendliness allows you to come closer to. If you're more friendly to somebody, you know, you can come. You can, if you don't like them, don't have to love them, like them even. But you can be friendly, be hospitable, be civil to them. So I don't love my aversion, yeah, but I can be friendly to it and recognize, well, I don't like my aversion, but sorry, that's the way I am. Right now, anyway. That's what this body mind, how it reacts that way. That's part of me, see. Yeah. So being more friendly to it allows me to come closer and make friends with my aversion. So rather than me fighting with my aversion and creating more aversion, I can be more friendly towards it, and I get a different relationship to it. And, you know, kind of primarily speaking, aversion is necessary too. If you don't have some aversion to the snakes around here, you know, if you're too high-minded and just think, go out and pet that brown snake, would be here probably, I think. So it does, it has survival value too, but usually we overdo it. We have a very, very small pain tolerance level, so a lot of things we could averse to, but we don't really need to. But then when you're more, you be more friendly to it, you can come closer and understand it. You know, when is it so-called necessary, and when am I overplaying it, over-dramatizing it? Or when has it become part of my ego structure? Well, would you call walking meditation active meditation?
Or? Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
But is there any other forms of?
Well, I would say anything, any activity where you can maintain some degree of clarity, mindfulness, awareness. You can turn anything into it. I mean, there are certain kind of sort of exercises, if you like yoga, tai chi, qi kung, which are based, have a meditative base to them. In order to actually do them, you need to have some kind of awareness, clarity, what you're doing, to be able to do the exercises properly, so to speak. Yeah. So they emphasize, you know, awareness and concentration and these qualities. Yeah. But you can actually do anything if you can, as a source, as a way of increasing concentration and awareness. I mentioned to somebody in Switzerland, I suggested they just, because this person did quite a bit of walking in the mountains, you know, use that as a meditation, mountain walking, bush walking here. You know. And I think people probably don't even realize it, but probably a lot of people do these kind of sports, like skiing and bicycle riding, because it helps them get concentration. You know, when they're really present with what they're doing, they forget themselves. And then they say, oh, wow, I feel so wonderful when I do that exercise. But they feel wonderful because they forgot about their problems, you see. It wasn't the exercise so much. I mean, of course, there is a physical aspect to it. But because they're so focused on what they're doing, they forget about their problems. And so they feel wonderful because they have no problems. Then they say, riding a bicycle is the way to go. But it just creates concentration. So you can ride your bicycle to get concentration. You can sit meditation to get concentration. You can walk to get concentration. But it's the concentration part of it, not the bicycle riding. See? So people can misunderstand it. And another, I think even people going off into the mountains in Switzerland, where I stayed for quite a long time, you know. People go there and then they say, oh, it was a I'm just so happy, such a wonderful experience being in the mountains. Because during that time they're in the mountains, they forget themselves. And then they say, oh, Switzerland is a wonderful country, you know, it makes me feel so happy. But it was this being absorbed into this beautiful scenery, the act of being absorbed away from yourself, that made them feel so wonderful. Not Switzerland. Just because it's got mountains, that's why. But and I mean, the monastery is in the middle of the Swiss Alps. So we used to have one day a week, we'd have a walking day, a Wandertag in the mountains, you see. And it was like walking meditation day. And you're out there in the mountains. I mean, what's to think about? Except survival. You know, but the monastery's way down there somewhere, you know, so I can just forget about it for the day anyway. And then I come back there, and then I'm coming in the door, somebody's saying, Ajahn, there's a telephone call for you. Ajahn, there's a bill to pay. Ajahn, I'm going back to the mountains, bye-bye. The mountains don't bother me. So basically, you know, anything, any kind of activity, if you enjoy it, it's even better, see. Because joy is also a factor of awakening. Right? Yeah, the Buddha said that. It's not my opinion. But joy is a factor of awakening. So if you enjoy something, gardening or swimming or whatever, you know, it also supports concentration. You know, it's sort of like a feedback loop. You know, something you enjoy, you do, gives you more concentration. More concentration gives you more joy. A very healthy feedback loop then. But if you just keep in mind, the activity is not, you know, to build muscles or to get it done, but to increase concentration and awareness, then it's active meditation. Cooking meditation. I know a lot of Thais, they developed cooking meditation, right? Right, cooking meditation? Is it meditation or are you talking a lot? Yeah. Could be cooking, could be meditation. There was one.
The 40 that you mentioned, what would be the meditation for lust, greed, or addiction?
Well, in general, it's called the meditation on the unbeautiful. The unbeautiful, asubha kamatan. What is the cause? Basically, the cause of greed is that we focus on the beauty of things, you see. In reality, there isn't anything such as beauty and ugliness. You know? But our ego focuses on beauty, and then it wants it. And you have desire for it and greed for it. See? So in one way, it's a misperception. See? And the way to it's an imbalance of perception, if you like. So the way to help with to get a rebalance is now to observe the unbeautiful. And there's various ways you can do that. I mean, there's some specific exercises, and then there's to have this theme, and then you can develop it yourself, what to do, how to use it, what's the unbeautiful aspect. Just to get a balance. I mean, again, some people, I think, have misused it in the sense that they kind of suppress their lust or their greed by saying, no, it's ugly, it's ugly, it's ugly. Really it is. It's not beautiful, it's ugly. Well, it's just another misperception. And it's even, you know, it's coming out of the wrong place. You're going to get even more serious misperceptions or hallucinations or whatever out of it. But, you know, the unbeautiful is there already. Just a matter of we don't notice it. When you walk around, you don't look for the garbage. You look for the flowers, right? Well, I do anyway.
Meditation of the unbeautiful doesn't feel as enjoyable as friendly.
Not all medicine tastes the same, huh?
Yeah.
If you know what's healthy for you, if you want to be healthy. Yeah. So you've been sitting here for an hour anyway, more than an hour and a half already. And the retreat continues tomorrow, same time, same place, I think. 5:30, is it?
Yes.
5 o'clock, wake up.
5 o'clock, wake up, 5:30 in the sauna. And then chanting at 6
30.
Yes, yes.
The clock goes back 1 hour. If two becomes one.
Well, put your clock back before you go to sleep tonight.
Smart.
I already put mine back.
What?
Yes, I forget. So it's only 8:30. The night is still young. But you've probably been sitting here for an hour and a half, so maybe your knees aren't so young anymore. So we'll finish there.
Sangha namah.